Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
You've heard about SARS, AIDS, and bird flu. Now researchers from Australia claim we're about to be hit by a new epidemic, motivational deficiency disorder.
According to the British Medical Journal, one in five people are said to suffer from motivational deficiency disorder, or MODD, and most don't even know they have it. Symptoms include being unable to get out of bed in the morning, being trapped on the couch, or wanting to spend the entire day at the beach.
Hello, this is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, and I'm Jane Shields. You too, or your children, may be suffering from this mental illness.
The condition varies from very mild. There are people who perhaps notice a slight reluctance to get out of bed on Monday morning at the mild end of the spectrum, through to the most severe disease, which is potentially fatal. These are people who find themselves at times in an acute attack, unmotivated to breathe, and these people will die.
I mean, all my life people have called me lazy, but now we know I was sick, and that's why I've set up the patient group, Unmotivated Anonymous. We've got some corporate sponsorship, we've got a website, and we intend to raise public awareness about this genuine disease.
You might have guessed by now that this is not actually a genuine disease. It's a fictitious disorder, created to show how easily normal human behaviour can be turned into illness. The satirical documentary was launched at a conference on disease mongering in Newcastle last year. The medicalisation of the human condition and behaviour is by now well established, as the big drug companies hunt for more and more illnesses to cure. Society is changing too. There's less tolerance of people who are different, eccentric, slow, or a bit odd. Children are the latest targets. Just listen to some of the many mental health disorders said to affect children.
Separation anxiety disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder. Tic disorder.
Pervasive development disorder. Conduct disorder. Disruptive behaviour disorder.
Oppositional defiant disorder. Reactive attachment disorder. Developmental coordination disorder.
There's no doubt there are children who are more than just shy or cheeky or rebellious or unusual. Some children have serious disturbances that can and should be helped. But Background Briefing has been told that in America, there are research projects looking for bipolar mood disorder in children who aren't even born yet. And advertisements like this fuel the fire.
Our problem started when he was 4 years old.
No daycare could handle our son. He was just too violent
and unpredictable. I had to protect the other children from his
outbursts, mood swings. I see a lot of cases like this.
Your child may be facing a chemical problem that you can't manage without help. If you or someone you know is living with bipolar disorder, call us to participate in our research study.
It's heartbreaking. No one understands the pain.
We're Mass General. We can help.
That's an advertisement from Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital. It's home to one of the leaders in diagnosing bipolar mood disorder in children, Dr. Joseph Biederman, who says that many cases of ADHD are in fact bipolar. In America since 1990, the rate of diagnosis of juvenile bipolar has increased dramatically. But it's not just bipolar disorder that's said to be appearing more in children.
A new psychological study of modern children has found an alarming increase in the incidence of a number of mental illnesses. The Danish study of 700,000 children born in the 1990s found, for instance, that the number of Tourette's syndrome cases had doubled, and there were three times as many kids diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. The researchers say it's not clear whether the rise is real and caused by environmental factors, or whether it can be put down to increased awareness and better diagnosis by doctors.
Around the world, there are indications that up to one in six children have some form of mental health problem. But in Adelaide, at the Women's and Children's Hospital, Associate Professor of Psychological Medicine, John Girardini, is worried that figures like this are misleading.
The way in which people are more and more defining mental disorder is that any significant distress or disturbance that a person experiences seems to be now being defined as a mental disorder.
Is that spilling over into childhood mental health?
Yes, the same thing applies in child mental health. Surveys show that anything up to 15% of children are suffering from mental disorder at any one time. Now, I think what we're doing is we're picking up any child who's distressed or dysfunctional, but we don't really have good reason to believe that that's because they've got some kind of disorder.
Professor Giordani says children often react to social stresses and pressures that even adults find difficult.
If you take a child under pressure, there's a very limited repertoire of ways in which they can respond to that. Hopefully they can talk about it and approach their parents and stuff, but when kids can't do that, it comes out in one of a very small number of ways and can come out as behaviour problems, or it can come out as withdrawal and disengagement. And the former tends to be labelled as ADHD or a variety of other illness labels that we have for kids with behaviour that we don't like, and the latter tends to be labelled as depression or anxiety.
And psychologists say that the quest to create near-perfect children who are happy and have lots of friends and do well at school can be counterproductive. One outspoken critic of the rush to medicalise normal temperaments and shifting moods is Professor of Psychiatry at Cardiff University in Wales, David Healy.
Children have always been unhappy and they've been nervous and they've also had problems. But about 10 to 15 years back, words we would have used for children would have been to say that they were maybe anxious or that they were under stress. And these words actually pointed to the context in which children lived. They actually pointed to the fact that things could have been going wrong for the child at home, or they could be going wrong actually maybe in school. And these were things that the focus of our help to these children was on actually putting things like this right. In recent years, we've actually begun to talk more about children having a mood disorder, either being clinically depressed or having a bipolar mood disorder.
Even in America, not everyone is convinced about the way many children are being diagnosed. From Boston, psychiatrist Dr. Jennifer Harris.
In the field of psychiatry in general, there's been a move away from therapy and Freudian analysis, which had been really dominant in like the 50s and 60s. There's been a move away from that towards a more biological model. And bipolar disorder was seen as a very biological disorder. And by biological, I think people often mean genetic. I think that focus on something more biological plays into parents' own desire to feel like they're not at fault, or doesn't have to do with child rearing or something like that, or they don't want to feel like their child has a mental health condition. It's better to think that there's something biologically wrong.
The maximum highs are better than the maximum lows, because the maximum lows are rages. And
since the 1990s, America has been leading the way in diagnosing children, in some cases as young as two, with what's called juvenile bipolar, or early onset bipolar.
Running around screaming and yelling and throwing and hitting and sometimes even biting.
Between the phone calls and the teachers and the paperwork and the doctors, there really is a lot like behind the scenes. If people don't live it, you don't really understand it.
There are websites, online parent forums, specialized clinics and research foundations all dedicated to the disorder. There's also a best-selling book, The Bipolar Child, The Definitive and Reassuring Guide to Childhood's Most Misunderstood Disorder. Its author, Dr. Dimitri Papoulos, runs the Juvenile Bipolar Research Foundation, a charitable organisation established to investigate the causes, consequences and treatment for the disorder. Background Briefing spoke to Dr. Papoulos on the phone from Connecticut.
Most children, probably about 80% of children with early onset bipolar disorder, have very rapid swings of mood, abrupt, rapid changes in mood that occur within the day and that can occur multiple times within the day. And that's one of the distinguishing features and perhaps one of the hallmarks of the condition, as opposed to bipolar disorder in adults, where there are significantly longer periods of mania and depression.
Dr. Papoulos, whose book has sold 200,000 copies, firmly believes that there are many young children with bipolar mood disorders.
Children, when they get manic, often get very silly, goofy, giddy, and elated, and then they just as easily descend into very low energy periods of withdrawal and often intense boredom and social withdrawal. And during those times, they often have self-recriminations and sometimes suicidal thoughts. And these rapid mood shifts are pretty characteristic. And there are obviously other features that are pressured speech, racing thoughts, significant hyperactivity, easy excitability, you know, intense emotions. Those are some of the features of the manic and hypomanic phase of the condition and the way the moods appear within the day.
Some estimates say up to 1 million American children have bipolar, and the idea of the bipolar child has captured the attention of the media there too. Here's one report from earlier this year.
Diagnosing and understanding mental illness is a big challenge for doctors, especially when they're treating children, which actually happens much more often than it used to.
Good morning, Hannah. That's right. One of the fastest growing diagnoses in children is bipolar disorder. It's a mental illness that causes extreme mood swings, highs and lows that can be debilitating. And these kids can't just snap out of it.
At age 6, Haley was diagnosed with a laundry list of psychiatric disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, Tourette's syndrome, and above all, bipolar disorder. It manifests itself in sudden mood swings with depression and anxiety, something the family calls episodes.
I always have to be doing something.
Even within the American psychiatry community, there are many differences of opinion, not only about the existence of bipolar disorder in very young children, but also the ways in which it can show up, and of course the treatment. Dr. Jennifer Harris, who you heard from earlier, has worked at the inpatient unit of Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital, where one of the leaders in the debate, Dr. Joseph Biederman, is based. She now works in private practice, but says during her time working at the hospital, she saw increasing numbers of children who'd been referred due to bipolar disorder. Most, she says, had been misdiagnosed.
Often when you have irritable, explosive, aggressive children, they end up getting labeled as bipolar disorder. And the problem is that lots of different things can lead to kids being irritable, explosive, and aggressive, or any one of those three things. But I think, unfortunately, too commonly, it just gets labeled as bipolar disorder, and then there's a whole host of assumptions about treatment that short-circuit really a more thorough, comprehensive evaluation.
Dr. Harris has never herself diagnosed a pre-teenage child with bipolar disorder and says it's very rare in younger children.
I've probably seen 2, maybe 3 prepubescent kids who I was convinced had bipolar disorder or thought it was highly likely that they did out of many, many, many kids I've seen going through the inpatient units. I've seen many more than that come in with that diagnosis.
Dr. Harris recalls a case that she thinks explains where the diagnosis can go wrong.
There's a kid I'm thinking of who I saw in my private practice who had a really severe learning disability that had been missed and that affected his ability to read social cues. So what seemed, again, like kind of unexplained irritability, explosiveness, really when you understood his learning profile, you could figure out that it was coming from the way he was inappropriately reading these social cues. And once we kind of figured that out, the behaviors went away.
Dr. Harris doesn't deny that many of the children labelled with bipolar disorder are often very distressed, but she's concerned that the diagnosis brings with it a fast track to very serious medication. She specialises in treating children's disorders without the use of drugs that she says come with long-term side effects, including liver and kidney damage. In the UK, Cardiff University psychiatry professor David Healy is an outspoken critic of doctors who diagnose bipolar too readily. He says bipolar illness in children is very rare, and he's astonished at the enthusiasm among some psychiatrists to look for signs of this illness in children.
Just to give you a feel for how crazy things have actually got recently, it would appear that clinicians in the US are happy to look at the ultrasounds of children in the womb, and based on the fact that they appear to be more overactive at times and then possibly less active later, they're prepared to actually consider the possibility that these children could be bipolar.
So, the obvious question is, why this search for serious mental illness in ever younger children? One possible reason for the dramatic increase in bipolar diagnosis is that in America in the past 10 years, the more serious an illness a child has, the more likely it is that the doctor will be funded to treat it. Dr. Jennifer Harris.
One of the things that happened is that people were no longer getting reimbursed for having more benign diagnoses.
15 years ago, she says, it was common to diagnose distressed children with conditions like adjustment reaction, indicating that a child's behaviour was a short-term response to some change or trauma that they might have been experiencing. This diagnosis, which basically means you help the child adjust and give it support, is no longer accepted for funding.
I don't get reimbursed for that. On the other hand, if I just put in a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, NOS, I get reimbursed. So bipolar disorder is thought to be a more serious, in quotes, diagnosis, and is much more easily reimbursed. I think that is part of what drives this. It's hard to get good treatment for kids. The child mental health care system is overburdened. It's hard to access resources. And if you have a diagnosis like bipolar disorder, you are much more likely to get services. You're much more likely that your insurance company is going to pay for it. You're much more likely that your school district might pay for you to go to a special school. So the financial pressures, I think, are real and impact this tremendously.
You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, and I'm Jane Shields. The music you're hearing is the creation of 15-year-old Ambrose, working on his computer at his home in Newcastle. He's a little eccentric, doesn't always fit in, but he likes who he is, and his mother thinks he's great. He's no longer taking any medication at all, but it wasn't always like that. Background Briefing went to visit Ambrose and his mother, Christina, at their home in an inner city suburb of Newcastle.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, how are you going?
Not bad. How are you, Christina?
Oh, good, thank you.
That's good.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Come in. Ambrose.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for agreeing to have a chat to us.
Yeah.
What about we just sit down?
Christina and Ambrose rent a modest two-story terrace near the centre of the city. A small fire is fighting the cold winter's afternoon in Newcastle. Ambrose has a mop of dark hair and is wearing a black T-shirt of 1970s punk band The Clash, along with some Steptoe gloves. Ambrose was put on medication when he was six after he was diagnosed with ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. His mother Christina recalls that his teachers said they were concerned about him.
I was a new mum. I was only quite young, you know, in my early 20s, and wasn't sure what was going on, you know. I found him to be quite a normal, as in ordinary, kid at home and didn't have a problem with his behaviour. And then when he hit the school, that's when it all started to happen.
According to his teachers, Ambrose simply refused to conform with his classmates and was determined to do his own thing. Christina says while the school saw only a naughty child, to her he always seemed bright and independent.
Ambrose could read at a very early age. He was very articulate. He would use lots of big words and would have an adult conversation, wasn't shy at all, didn't really care about me. He would just, or his dad, he would just do whatever he wanted to do.
One of the things he insisted on doing was wearing a strange hat to school.
He liked to wear this hat, this pork pie hat that was his grandfather's, and he wore that from third class. And it was quite strange for a little boy to want to wear this hat. And in the playground, they had to wear a hat. It was compulsory. But he wanted to wear this pork pie, tweed, you know, old man sort of hat, which he thought it was wonderful. And, of course, he used to stand out with all the other kids and the parents. Mm. And there was he was never shy, or he would go straight up to anybody and introduce himself, and he didn't have a problem with how he was. He didn't care that people were looking at him. He didn't care that he wore it. I think he liked the fact of wearing an unusual hat, you know. His father used to have arguments with him where I just go, okay, if you want to wear the hat, wear the hat. It wasn't worth an argument.
His father was a bit worried about what reaction he'd get?
Yeah, I think so, because he did stand out, and because he was a naughty boy, well, in the teacher's eyes, he would make himself stand out more with this hat, you know, and he wore that right up until sixth class. And now those hats are cool, so.
At the time, IQ tests confirmed that Ambrose had above average intelligence. But while he didn't have a learning disability, he continued to cause problems for his teachers.
He wasn't a run-of-the-mill kid. He wasn't conforming like all the other kids, and he was defiant and running away and hiding, causing lots of problems. And they said to me, you should take him to a paediatrician. The school suggested that. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, my child, how can you say that? To me, he's perfect. I thought, well, they don't want him at this school.
After visiting the paediatrician, Ambrose and his parents were told that he had ADHD. Christina says she was confused by the diagnosis.
She diagnosed him within an hour, within one consultation. Basically, I took his school reports, which was the first term of kinder, and the reports that were from the preschool that they had done and the university had done. Basically, she asked me a few questions and she said he has ADHD.
What was your response to that?
Well, I thought, well, I've seen, you know, A Current Affair and all those programs and Today Tonight, and he wasn't like those children. He wasn't running around and jumping on furniture and screaming and swearing and abusing me and hitting me, and he wasn't like that at all. At home, he was a good kid.
Unsatisfied, Christina followed up to seek a second opinion on whether Ambrose really did have ADHD.
And the next doctor, that's what your son has. He has not ADD, ADHD. So he didn't have any learning difficulties. He didn't have the aggressiveness. He just was impulsive and would just not listen. So this doctor decided that he should go on medication, which I really didn't like the idea of at all. I was really frightened. I don't know anything about it. You know, we were really confused and upset about the whole thing.
Despite her hesitation, Christina began giving Ambrose Ritalin, and things did settle down at school. But Ambrose hated taking the medication.
And I remember kids saying to me, that's mental people's drugs and only retarded people take drugs like that, that I was like a psycho or something. So what I used to do is I never used to really tell any of my friends that I had ADHD or was on medication or anything, because I didn't want people to pick on me, or that was around about year two, year three or something.
Did you feel different to the kids your own age?
Yeah, definitely. Like everyone else would be doing something else and I'd be, I don't know, trying to find out a bit. It's like they're A and I'm Q, for example, in alphabet terms. So they'd be off at one side of the school and I'd be over at the other.
Despite their differences, Ambrose said the kids at primary school learned to accept him as he was. But later at high school, he once again struggled to fit in and was severely bullied.
Even though they think that they overpower me because they're in numbers, but I think in my own mind that I am more mentally stronger. Like I can see something from a different perspective when they're just, you're a loser, you're fag, you're nothing, pretty much, and we hate you, and it's like, that's not cool. And I don't know. It's not very nice.
Now, I guess that's pretty unusual for a boy your age to be able to see that from that perspective and be pretty confident in who you are.
Yeah, pretty confident in who I am. I get on with my friends pretty well, but it's really hard for me to go out in public places sometimes, because sometimes I see them and, like, for example, about a week ago I was on the bus going to see some friends and I heard some kids that know me, because I heard them talking, like, saying stuff that they wanted to follow me off the bus and bash me or something, but I quickly got off the bus and ran, so I got away from that, but... Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to get around.
As his early high school years became more and more difficult, his paediatrician suggested to his mother that he perhaps should see a psychiatrist.
And I thought, oh, gee, you know, like, psychiatrist. That really frightened me, just the word itself. And I thought, oh, well, okay then. If he still needs medication, well, we're going to have to do that. So we made the appointment and took him to this psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist diagnosed him and said, oh no, he hasn't got ADHD. He has Asperger's. He's just eccentric. He hasn't got the hyperactive nature. You know, he hasn't got learning difficulties. And said, oh my God, he's been taking medication for ADHD since he was 6 years old. And now he's 13, 14, and no, he doesn't need that at all. he should be taking antidepressants. So, yeah, that was really hard to hear, you know, I'd been giving him one medication for all these years for the wrong illness, or so I thought.
What did the psychiatrist say was made him think that it was actually Asperger's?
Oh, he had all of his school reports and the psychologist's reports, the school counsellor's reports. He had a couple of sessions with him and just said that he has a mild form of autism, very mild form of it, and that he just needs to learn to organise himself and things would be a lot better for him.
The diagnosis also took Ambrose by surprise.
Straight away he diagnosed me with having Asperger's syndrome, and it was a bit strange, and he gave me prescription straight away for these new drugs, and I didn't really trust them that much because I went and did some research about the drugs, and like they were really like high, what's the word?
High powered kind of drugs.
Drugs, yeah. See, Ritalin is a moderately powered drug, but it's not like a complete brain altering sort of drug, but
what were some of the things you found out about the drugs that he recommended?
They said that it changed personality and it can kind of distort the way you perceive things. And I'm not sure about that really, because I don't really want to, as much as I'd like to be able to focus and maybe do my studies better and be able to concentrate better, but I don't want to have to change who I am. And I'm happy with the way I am, and I think all I can do now is just continue school, get stuff done, and see what happens from there.
Ambrose isn't taking any medication now. He's in Year 10 at a new school that caters especially for kids who don't cope in mainstream school for one reason or another. Ambrose plans to finish Year 12 and then go on to study at university. So many children seem to have been diagnosed with ADHD that it's become fodder for comedy and satire shows, like the cult program South Park.
Hello, I'm Dr. Richard Shea, here to tell you about my exciting new drug-free treatment for children with attention deficit disorder. This treatment is fast and effective and doesn't use harmful drugs. Watch closely as I apply treatment to the first child. Sit down and study! Sit down and study! Stop crying and do your schoolwork! If you would like more information on my bold new treatments, please send away for this free brochure entitled, You Can Either Calm Down or I Can Pop You in the Mouth Again.
In Sydney's inner west, Background Briefing went to the Rivendell Child and Adolescent Unit at Concord. Professor Philip Hazel has spent more than 20 years working with children with mental health problems. He's now the director at Rivendell.
Hi, Philip. Jane from Background Briefing.
Hi, Jane.
Pleased to meet you.
Welcome to Rivendell.
Thank you.
The unit sits in a sandstone building on 63 acres on the shores of the Parramatta River and provides a child and adolescent mental health service, including inpatient rooms for more than 20 adolescents, along with a high school.
The kids are in class at the moment, mm-hmm. So we won't be able to interrupt them.
Philip Hazel gave Background Briefing a look around the Rivendell schoolrooms.
The classes are divided according to our clinical programs. So there are two classes dedicated to kids with predominantly mood problems, two classes dedicated to kids with psychosis, Asperger's, autism syndromes. And then there is a separate program for kids with disruptive behaviour disorders. Those kids are not necessarily enrolled as patients here at Rivendell. And another program which is dedicated to young people who are unlikely, owing to their mental illness or other difficulties, to ever get back into mainstream school. So it's a transition program, usually into TAFE or vocational training.
Back in Professor Hazel's office, he talks of his many years treating young children with behaviour problems at a specialist clinic he began in Newcastle.
There are some mental disorders which occur right across the lifespan, so they're the same, effectively the same disorders in children as adults. Good examples of that would be anxiety and depression. But there are also some disorders which we most commonly associate with childhood, so conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. While people improve and maybe grow out of their problems, some continue to have difficulties even in adulthood. And then there are conditions which are classically childhood conditions but continue to affect people in their adulthood, such as autism.
Now, you've just mentioned their conduct disorders and oppositional defiant disorders. Could you explain for us what that term actually means?
Oppositional defiant disorder, I'll begin with. What that represents, basically, is a persistence of negativistic, tantrumy, oppositional behaviour that is quite normal in most 2 and 3 year olds, but you shouldn't expect to still be seeing in somebody who's 7, 8, 9. And that's what it is. It's that kind of toddler-like behaviour that you're still seeing in somebody who's quite a bit older and should really have left it behind. Mm. Conduct disorder is really a step towards delinquency or adult antisocial behaviour. So it's characterised by more sneaky behind-the-scenes behaviour like truanting, stealing, lying, being deceitful, but can also be characterised by aggression, so bullying, harassment, even sexual aggression to other people.
Philip Hazel is among those who say that far from being overdiagnosed, mental illnesses in children are probably underdiagnosed. His research in the Hunter Valley showed only a third of the children with ADHD were picked up and treated. He thinks that ADHD stands out because other kinds of mental illnesses are even more underdiagnosed.
For example, probably only about 1 in 10 kids with anxiety or depression ever get to specialist services.
But Professor Hazel says diagnosing mental health problems in children is extremely sensitive and complex.
There is a risk that ADHD will be diagnosed when, in fact, the child has a different problem. And it's understandable because ADHD is a very common problem and you tend to diagnose common things first. But there are other difficulties or other problems that could explain why a kid is not concentrating well or is hyperactive or fidgety. And they include more rare conditions such as autism. They also include anxiety, even depression. And I guess a controversial diagnosis, but the possibility of bipolar disorder.
There is some concern that, particularly in the United States, children as young as 2, I've seen quoted, have been diagnosed as bipolar. And there's some scepticism about whether one can actually diagnose someone that young with bipolar. You're involved in research into paediatric bipolar. What's the latest feeling?
It would be good probably if we didn't refer to it as bipolar disorder and found another name for it in children, because the difficulty at the moment is that by calling it bipolar disorder, there's an assumption that we're talking about the exact same condition as affects adults. Within the population of young people who might have bipolar disorder, the answer is that some probably do, and the older the age of the young person, the more likely it is that it truly is bipolar disorder. The younger, the more doubt you have. At the moment, there aren't sufficient long-term data of children identified with bipolar to say with great certainty that, yes, the kids we identify with bipolar in childhood actually have the adult disorder. So it's a bit of a cliche, but the jury is still out.
Professor Philip Hazel, Director of Rivendell Child and Adolescent Unit. There are children who are so disturbed they may end up at a hospital. Head of the Children and Adolescent Psychiatric Unit at Westmead Hospital is Dr. Jean Starling, and Background Briefing spoke to her while she was on a short break in New Zealand. She says many children come in through the emergency department at Westmead, and she says the most common childhood mental disorders are anxiety and depression.
There's some concern that we are seeing more and more unhappiness and depression in children, especially primary school children.
Is that something you've seen in your own work experience at Westmead Children's Hospital?
Yes, I would certainly now be seeing children who are in late primary school who present to us because they're either desperately unhappy or sadly they've attempted to hurt themselves.
Even in primary school?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's much more common, again, very sadly in adolescence, but we would be seeing now some 10, 11 and 12-year-olds who are also very unhappy.
And it's a change that you've observed only in the more recent years?
Look, it does appear to be, and I suppose a little hard for us to know if that's because we weren't seeing them in the past or if the pressures that teenagers have been under for some time are now moving down into the younger age groups.
Dr. Starling says she's seeing more and more families under stress and thinks that young children are sharing these adult worries with their parents. And she says the changing dynamics of a competitive world mean there are all sorts of new pressures on children.
I think one of the factors is that the pressures in life to succeed and to do well are actually being put onto children younger. You see quite a lot now of children going for the selective school examinations, for example, and there appears to be a belief in some children that if you don't get into a selective high school, then it's somehow affected your future very severely. And that's a fairly new thing for me, to be seeing children very distressed by that. another reason that children can sometimes get distressed is because of bullying or difficulties in school. And I think, again, that's becoming more of a problem in some areas.
How do you go about distinguishing normal behaviour from abnormal, in inverted commas? At what point do you call something a disorder, perhaps?
Look, that's a really good question. And the line between what's normal and what's abnormal is quite difficult. It's very clear when somebody's very severely depressed. That is not hard to pick. But I would say that it crosses over into a disorder when it starts affecting your life and when it lasts for a long period of time. So with a child, you know, a child will often have a period of time, a day or so, where they're unhappy about a particular situation. But when the unhappiness lasts for 2 or 3 weeks, and also it starts affecting the way they interact with their family and their friends, and it starts affecting the way they perform at school, then I think it becomes a problem. It's also a problem, of course, if they start feeling so bad that they think that life's not worth living, or they consider hurting themselves.
The fact that some children will actually feel so miserable and hopeless that they'll want to end their lives or hurt themselves is at one end of a spectrum of mental disorders. At the other end are people who may have a disorder, such as Asperger's, who can, with a little help, usually get along well in society. International studies show an increase in the autism spectrum of disorders, but it's not clear whether this is from more awareness of the condition or a real increase brought about by changes in society. Dr. Starling.
One of the theories that would go along with that would be that these days you need to have a very high level of social skills to be able to function in most occupations. So the occupations where very few social skills were needed and where you could work at a very simple task in isolation, such as working on a factory processing line, have now gone. And a lot of jobs these days are in the service industries, the professions, the trades, where you do need to have very high level social skills. So it's possible that people without those skills weren't noticed in the past and they were just seen as eccentric and would somehow fit into a job of some kind where they didn't need to have social interaction.
So they've just become Joe Blow, the unusual one.
Yes, that's right. And Joe Blow might pot around in somebody's garden or maybe work on a factory processing line, and he could have a successful life and have a successful job. But his options are now much less than they were.
Dr. Jean Starling, head of the Children and Adolescent Psychiatric Unit at Westmead Hospital in Sydney.
I'm going to play football with you, John. No. You must be going to play cricket this year, then, are you, John? Nah. Well, you sure are a funny kid, Johnny. But I like you. So tell me, what kind of boy are you, John?
Since 1983, there's been an ongoing national project investigating whether a child's temperament can predict how they'll cope with life. Part of the team leading the research of the Australian Temperament Study is Melbourne paediatrician Dr. Frank Obertlade, who's the head of the Centre for Community Child Health at the Royal Children's Hospital and a professor of paediatrics.
We followed almost 2,500 Australian children from the time they're about 4 to 6 months of age. They're now well into their 20s and having children of their own. And we're very interested to try and tease out the influence that temperament had on these kids as they got older, on their behaviour, on their adjustment, on their school performance, on the way parents managed their behaviours and so on.
It was presumed that a person's temperament is driven largely by genetics, but is also affected and shaped by the environment in which they grow up.
So about 10-15% of children are born with what we call a difficult temperament. That is, they tend to be fairly active, they tend to be intense, they have difficulty as an infant in getting into a predictable routine. So these are kids that are challenging for any parent. They're harder to manage, if you like, than the quote-unquote average child. Irrespective of how good the parents were, irrespective of the techniques they used, of how confident they were, these were kids that were just generally difficult to manage. And that's not fixed in stone, so that just because kids were difficult when they were infants and toddlers didn't mean that they continued to have difficulty right through life.
Clearly, parenting plays a big part in the way children develop their social skills and interaction. And the study showed that the relationship between parents and children has the potential to set the foundations for later life.
What we did find was that irrespective of the child's actual temperament, if in the infant and toddler years parents perceived that the child was difficult, then that was a very good predictor that the child stayed difficult. In other words, something if the interaction between the young child and parent sort of goes off the rails a little bit in those early years, irrespective of whether there's a genetic contribution or whether the child has a difficult temperament, then that is likely to go on to lead to problems later in life, certainly in the early school years. And there's also evidence, as we continue to follow these children, that to some extent we can predict longer-term behaviour problems.
The information collected about a child's temperament, the kind of parenting they were given in their earliest years, revealed some common elements or risk factors for mental health problems.
And the greatest predictors were a combination of difficult temperament, early difficult behaviour such as aggressive behaviour in the preschool years and so on, and harsh or rigid parenting. Those combinations seem to predict much more powerfully that these kids would go on to have later behaviour problems, later mental health problems.
The temperament study shows the complexity of determining the contribution of genetics, environment and parenting to a child's mental health in particular. But Dr. Obertlade says, regardless of the genetic makeup of a child's temperament, the study shows that children seem to fare best with parents who are willing to set boundaries.
The best parenting, irrespective of the temperament of the child, was what we call authoritative parenting, where parents set limits, were consistent in their parenting styles, understood that some of the behaviour isn't willful, that children at these developmental ages do exhibit often challenging behaviours and responded in appropriate ways.
I only like dreaming all the day long, and no one is screaming.
He had become more and more explosive in his temper.
He had started having really severe rages where he would get upset just about anything and go off.
General practitioners are usually the first to see children who have been brought in by parents who find their behaviour too difficult or who suspect something is very wrong. North of Brisbane on the Sunshine Coast, Dr. Scott Parsons was so concerned at the poor level of special services for children, he decided to specialise as a general practitioner working with children.
The waiting period to see a paediatrician was blowing out to 6 to 12 months for a child mental health disorder, and the same for the child psychiatrist. And so it really was a case whereby basically to try and facilitate some of these desperate parents and children, I had to start taking on some of the role as helping out with some of their child mental health issues.
For a GP, how do you begin to train yourself to make those distinctions between what might be a psychiatric issue, could be a parenting issue, or it could be a behavioural problem?
Yeah, you've really hit the nail on the head there, Joan, especially in GP sort of land where we really do only have a 15-minute appointment, which is obviously completely impossible to fully assess a situation. But you basically have to realise that what is a child mental health disorder, and the word there is disorder, and the child is not functioning to his age-related abilities. The first thing I'll do is get a fairly brief history, and often the parents are feeling guilty and feeling like a failure, or there's a lot of negativity associated, or they're particularly angry at either other people or the child. And so the first thing to do is to make them feel like those feelings are all very natural, and yes, we're going to try and help you with those feelings.
Dr. Scott Parsons says if he finds the problems are only at school or only at home, that is often good news.
And I try and say, well, look, that's really good news, because that's less likely that we're dealing with a mental health disorder, and more likely dealing with the challenges that parents are facing with managing their own relationship with a child. If it's clear that the parent's indicating that the school are desperate for help and the childcare is desperate for help, this child's probably got some sort of disorder whereby the child is providing too much of a challenge for the school and the peer groups and for the parents.
Scott Parsons wants to see more extensive and formal training available for all GPs to enable them to better care for children's mental health needs. There are already specialist GP diplomas in other things, such as obstetrics. In Adelaide, Associate Professor John Girardini says he too would like to see more recognition of the part that GPs play in handling mental health problems.
GPs know a lot about the kids that come to see them. They often know the kids themselves, but even if they don't, they often know the family and they know the community that the child comes from. And building on that understanding is something that we think GPs can do very readily. But too often, the approach to teaching psychiatry to GPs is about teaching them tricks with drugs and so on, and I don't think that's the right approach for them to take.
John Giordini is Professor of Psychological Medicine at the Women's and Children's Hospital in Adelaide and has worked as a child psychiatrist for 20 years. During that time, he says there's been benefits and costs to the changing recognition of mental health problems.
There's an increased recognition, and the recognition is made up of at least two components. The first positive component is that we're recognising some mental disorder that previously we were missing. But the second and by far the larger and the more worrying component is that we're labelling a lot of stuff as mental disorder that hasn't always been labelled as such.
He's particularly concerned with the move away from treating environmental factors.
There are harms and benefits to any label, and sometimes making an appropriate diagnostic label is a huge relief to people because it makes sense of something that they've been experiencing. But it also carries costs, and some of the costs include the attribution of problems to things that can't be dealt with. So if you understand a child's behaviour problem, you know, because of their biological makeup, they've got ADHD or ODD or whatever, then that takes you away from trying to understand that problem in terms of the life circumstances that might have led the child to get there. So you might miss something. Then if you drug them in a way that improves their behaviour and makes them less of a problem to other people, then that may mask other things that are happening.
Meanwhile, at Cardiff University in Wales, psychiatry professor David Healy continues to be very vocal about what he calls the medicalisation of childhood.
What we've lost in the process is the capacity for both parents and actually the doctors that they go to see to say, well, look, wait a minute here. Children always have been unhappy. They always have been nervous. But that's actually part and parcel of being a child. You have to go through these things. This is how we learn to cope with the problems of life.
He says that it's important to remember that severe mental illness in children is rare and that most children with a mental health problem do not need to be treated with medications.
These children can be helped best and in actually the safest way if they're just seen and if they actually have the opportunity to talk about their problems and if they get basic and sensible input about how to perhaps help them cope with these problems. And it is useful to have pills in reserve for the children who don't respond to these kind of approaches. But at the moment, the problem is that we seem to be actually picking up children ever earlier, where it's actually leading to children being picked up and put on pills who really don't need to be on these pills and who are going to be injured by them.
Do you think in the 21st century that there is an overdiagnosis of mental health problems within the Western world's children's population?
Yes, I do. And I think actually the problem is hugely disturbing. I think possibly 10 to 15 years up the road, we're going to be looking at a generation of children who will have been seriously injured by the treatments that they appear ever increasingly likely to be put on now.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research, Anna Whitfeld. Technical producer, Mark Don. And executive producer, Kirsten Garrett. I'm Jane Shields and this is ABC Radio National. Links to websites and other information mentioned in today's program will be posted on our website.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.